From the creators of Relevant Magazine, this is the Relevant Podcast.
Like lemonade.
Used to carry all the groceries in one trip.
Hercules.
Simply made it made, gone in one sip. Too much dip on my chip. Stiff on my chick to get my lip on.
It's Tuesday, June 4th, 2019, and it's the Relevant Podcast, a special edition. Well, in a second. I'm your host, Cameron Strang, and here with me in our Orlando studios on the ones and twos, our illustrious engineer, my brother, Chandler Strang.
Hello.
On the Skype line from Loverland, Virginia, Jesse Carey.
Hello, hello.
From Nashville, Tennessee, our senior editor, Tyler Huckabee.
Hey, everybody.
And that's it. We do not have, I think for the first time in podcast history, we don't have that last seat filled.
That's true.
We've done 780-ish episodes. We've always had, from my memory, other than maybe the first 10, four people plus somebody recording
us. And here's the thing. We typically have a pretty deep bench, too. You know? And I know know it's print week for us, but you would not believe how busy everyone else who's ever sat in this fourth seat is. And one person has disappeared entirely, and I'll get to that in a minute. And I'm frankly concerned.
I thought summer was like, you know, sun's out, guns out, you're relaxing. People aren't doing as much.
Yeah.
But no,
not our team. The
high achieving relevant podcast cast, they're out, they're traveling the world, they're crisscrossing, they're changing things, they're taking names. I mean,
there are literally a dozen people that was scheduled to be on today. And like I said, one missing person that we'll get to shortly. But listen, we got the skeleton crew. We're running lean, we're running hot. I can promise you.
A little bit more wiggle room. It's a little bit more wiggle room. There's more lane for us to occupy. Right. It's like when Kramer painted over the center line and he just started weaving. That's us this today.
I want to say this because, Cameron, I jumped into that Twitter conversation you referenced last week about, you know, someone concerned about the amount of nonsense and banter. And let me say this. If you're listening to this podcast for the first time, pause it right now and download like the last three, because this one's going to get weird. It's going to get real weird, and I don't care. This is just this is like those episodes of TGIF, like when Urkel and Uncle Jesse from, you know, like three different shows would come out and sit on the couch and directly address the viewer, and they just said like recap episodes, you know what I'm talking about?
They decided
construct of sitcoms, of TGIF, we're just tearing down the fourth wall, and now we're just talking to you directly because things don't make sense anymore. That's this episode.
Our fourth usually, and not all, and some people are better than others, we don't need to name names, but the fourth is usually sort of the tether, you know, our anchor. They keep things on the rails. They keep they're the seatbelt. They don't let us get too far, and that's not happening.
When there's
today.
A respectable person in the room,
all helium.
When there's a nice lady in the room, you sit up a little straighter. You know what I mean?
That's true.
You're not gonna give in to your that inappropriate joke that makes you smile, but you're holding it back because you don't know where she's coming from. No, you're gonna say it. She's not there.
Okay, to that point, Cameron, can you read the note I've left under banter? And that's all people need to know what they're getting into this episode.
I saw it. We'll get there. Despite everything we just said, we do actually have a great show in store
fantastic.
For you.
Yeah.
Coming up later, Heather Probably. Avis joins us. She's the author of the new book, Scoot Over and Make Some Room, My Story of Sitting Next to a Guy on a Plane Who Hogged the Armrest. No, it's called Scoot Over and Make Some Room, Creating a Space Where Everybody Belongs. She talks about making the church and our communities more diverse places. We're excited to have her.
Yeah, it's a great interview. It's a challenging interview. Man, I'm a huge fan of Heather.
To be clear, Scoot Over and Make Some Room has nothing to do with flying too close to a armrest hog on an airplane.
You know, the strategy means you need a tank top at every travel. So that means, because here's the thing, like if you're wearing a long sleeve or like a hoodie or something, people are more inclined to be like, well, I can touch a little fabric. No big deal.
Yeah, I wear the hoodie.
The whole exposed shoulder and arm hunched over that armrest, that thing is mine. No one's going, skin to skin. I mean, desperate times call for desperate measures, Tyler. If you really want that armrest, you will bear as much skin as you need to.
I do not.
Tank tops are now. They're new. Now that's sort of that's getting a little risky in today's climate, because Jesse, you and I were talking about this Catholic priest who's getting ratioed over Twitter because of this suggestion that people shouldn't wear tank tops to church.
Yeah.
Did you see this?
No,
I did see.
Oh,
this.
Yeah. this guy, he's at, last I checked, he's at 11,000 replies his suggestion to he's a priest, and he said that he doesn't think that women should be wearing tank tops to church anymore. He asked a woman who was wearing one to cover up. We're already into a conversation that would be very useful to have somebody like Annie around, but it's too late. It's too late. There's no net. There's no anchor.
Here's the thing.
We're already in it.
I've been wearing my cutoff. It's midriff bearing because that's when I'm you know, throwing around the old medicine ball. I like to have a lot of flexibility at my core. It's my midriff bearing.
You don't want to be tethered by the fabric.
Yeah. It's my midriff bearing cutoff Lord's Gym. Sure. I'm wearing that to church, you know, because preach the gospel at all times. When necessary, use a t-shirt of Jesus bench pressing the cross. So, you know, if he's got a problem with that, then, you know, take it up with the trash can, because that's where his opinion belongs.
The real inspiration. Father. Real inspiration.
All right, Jesse, in the notes for this opening segment of the show, where we typically just kind of, much to the chagrin of that new listener who tweeted us about it, this is the part of the show where we tend to just meander into whatever topical lane
we don't have time
percolates and just naturally happens. You know, thankfully I rescue it by moving on. We have other segments coming up.
We've already talked about tank tops for 7 minutes of the 8 minutes we've been recording. This is
the part of the show where there's no plans. We're flying fast and loose. For the first time in my memory, Jesse has written a show note under this section. The show note to me is Rambo trailer tossed to Jesse.
Guys, okay. This should be its own podcast, to be honest with you. I don't even know why we're doing the rest of a show this week. We should have two guests on Friday so we can dedicate the entire hour and a half to this. Okay. The biggest pop culture news of the year happened earlier this week when the trailer for Rambo Last Blood hit the internet. Okay. I feel like I need to provide a little context for why this is so significant. Because if longtime listeners of this show know that I and one of our former editors, Adam Smith, have been fans of the Rambo franchise for many, many years.
Ironic fans.
It started off as 8-year-olds as real fans, evolved into ironic fans. And then when Stallone just stopped caring entirely, very authentic, unironic fans, as we will see soon. So Adam and I, you know, were big fans of this. We would write our own scripts for Rambo films, which we would relentlessly submit to Sylvester Stallone. Stallone was actually on this podcast at one time and heard of one of Adam's ideas, to which he hung up shortly after. And I tried to get Adam on, and I have a theory of why I haven't been able to get a hold of him, because I've been in regular contact with Adam Smith now for about 15 years. And my only assumption is there was a surge of testosterone so forceful that it just knocked his heart out. I think he's in the ICU.
After he saw the trailer.
Just testosterone, just a surge. His body overdosed on testosterone just from seeing this trailer.
I saw over the weekend a relevant tweet, the breaking news that the Rambo trailer had been released with the soundtrack, the non-ironic soundtrack of Old Town Road.
That's right.
On the trailer. And so, I literally was like, I don't have time for this.
So here's what we need to do. I don't want to belabor this more than it needs to be. But I watched this trailer I watched it with my eyes closed several times, because I was like, this may be the first trailer in the history of movies that is even better if you don't see what's happening on screen. The other reason too is because clearly this was hand edited by Stallone himself, and the violence depicted is a hard R in the trailer alone. Like the little
What's the premise of this final installment of the Rambo franchise?
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about.
So as you know, of Rambo prior to this has retroactively won the Vietnam War single-handedly.
Really?
He defended Afghanistan from the Soviets single-handedly. Last time we found him, he was a professional snake hunter. That was literally his profession. He decided to retire from snake hunting to go single-handedly save a bunch of Christian missionaries from a compound in Burma. Okay, so we find this trailer opens. Close your eyes. In a minute, Chandler, we'll start the soundtrack, but I need to set the scene first. Rambo is now in his mid-70s. It opens with him sitting on a rocking chair in a house in the middle of the desert. What you're going to hear You're going to hear a lot of knives being sharpened. You're going to hear there's some booby traps. There appears to be a workout montage in an old barn like a Rocky film. Now, in your mind, you're wondering, I wonder what's happening on the screen. It's a montage of Stallone sharpening knives, shooting arrows, and taking down an entire conglomerate of Mexican drug cartels as a man in his 70s with nothing but a bow and arrow and knives.
Chandler, a bow and arrow. Wow.
Chandler, start playing. I will narrate as needed. Start with 7 seconds in. Here we go.
I've lived in a world of death.
It sounds like someone impersonating Sylvester Stallone at this point.
I've watched people I've loved die.
I've watched.
Some fast with a bullet. Some not enough left to bury.
At this point, Rambo's riding a horse, if you must know. He's quite literally riding to an old town road in the trailer. I'm pretty sure they shot this trailer with the intent of using Old Town Road.
But the time has come to face my past.
Okay, Rambo is now on the roof of a building fighting an entire Mexican drug cartel with his bare hands.
They will welcome death.
It should be noted, they are all heavily, heavily armed.
I want revenge.
I'm looking at Tyler on the screen right now. He is growing a beard as we speak.
I want them to know that death is coming.
Okay. So many things are exploding on camera right now, and they literally don't make sense. It's just random old barns are exploding.
Stop it.
Okay. Who is in? Who's Chandler? Are you not in?
I'm for it. I'm here for it.
Here's where I'm at. I feel like whoever edited this trailer, and let's be honest, we know who edited this trailer. Yeah. It was Sly.
And we know all too well who edited this.
He knew that Old Town Road was a phenom. Old Town Road.
It just came out like 2 months ago.
9 weeks at the number one spot. Nine weeks now.
Yeah.
But he didn't understand that in the internet era, like, you both love things and you're like, the line between sincerity and mocking something is gone. So it's like this ironic but not ironic love of the song. But he, Sylvester Stallone, heard the song. He's like, no, that's a song. He really felt it in his marrow. Like, he was like, ride till I can't no more. That's the Rambo ethos right there.
So in your theory, Tyler, they had already cut a trailer for this film months ago.
That's right.
They had a different song. They had like a much more probably apropos
and then
tune.
Stallone, who, judging by the plots of most of the films he had been in, does not understand what irony is.
Right.
Hears it with a sincere love, calls the studio and says, we got to hold off on this thing till I can get a special version, a Rambo version of this song recorded and edited into a trailer.
I'm sure he does it himself. I'm sure he opens up Pro Tools and he rips the song down. He probably buys it on iTunes, you know, like a normal. And that's how this trailer came to be, because he just loved the chorus about riding your horse till you can't ride no more that much.
I'm picturing Sylvester Stallone sweating profusely in a tank top, maybe a Lord's Gym tank top, just profusely sweating, wearing like those big studio engineer headphones, like in like a studio with like wood panel walls, and he's got like 5 monitors, and he's just furiously editing this for like 7 weeks straight. You know, job well done, Sly.
I also feel a little strange about the fact that this is a Lil Nas X song, but I believe they only used the Billy Ray Cyrus, the like 20 seconds of Billy Ray Cyrus over it. Yeah. I don't want to make any casting aspersions on Sly Stallone about that. I just noticed it, and it's a little strange.
It is. Yeah, it was an interesting creative decision, but I am here for this film and here for this trailer. You know, if people can't stomach the film, just watch the trailer like 7 times. You get the gist of the movie. I mean, you're all good from there. So you're welcome, world.
Your love of Rambo is the most surprising thing about you to me.
Why is that surprising?
Because
it seems like he embodies the spirit that I love.
I guess so. I guess. Just the unbridled enthusiasm you have for the wanton violence is the surprising part.
Here's
why.
You're
a very kind and empathetic person in real life.
No, I am. And like, I don't mind action movies, but I'm not like a big action movie buff. Right. I think it's just that he's Rambo, like Stallone only has one speed. And like I said, the thing that he's incapable of understanding unintentional hilarity, he's never made a comedy. Well, I guess he made like Throw Mom Off a Train or something like in the 80s or whatever, but like I don't think he really understands comedy. Like he's
Throw Mom Off a Train, you mean Stop or My Mom Will Shoot?
Yeah, well, it was one of those. I'm pretty sure Throw Mom Off a Train
Mom Off a Train.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah, I think both of them, I think, were Jesse's right. 80s. Yeah,
really?
Yeah. But I don't feel like, just given the title of that film alone, I don't feel like Stallone has a great grip on what's actually funny. You know,
he's not in Throw Mama from the Train. Danny DeVito and Billy Crystal are in Throw Mama from the Train. Just FYI.
That's a great cast.
Yeah. I mean,
I gotta put that one in the queue. Yeah.
The director of Throw Mama from the Train. Mr. Danny DeVito. He double dipped. He starred and directed.
Good for Danny DeVito.
That's the life.
What a career.
That's the life.
What a career that guy's had.
You guys know I'm a big DeVito fan. I do think, Jesse, here's where you lose me a little bit, is I'm a big fan. I think we talked about this because I'm a big fan of First Blood. I like the first Rambo a lot.
That's the one I don't like because it's too serious.
Because that one's like actually
good.
Has a real, there's like a real message. That's real commentary. Good. On Vietnam War. And then after that, it's where it loses me because then it's just Rambo being awesome.
Exactly.
But I think you're the revert. We're flipped on that.
The first one is like basically an indie movie about like PTSD and American society grappling with the aftermath of hardened veterans coming back from Vietnam. It's, you know, it's actually a good film. The second one is where he is plucked from a prison cell and asked to go, you know, save hundreds of POWs single-handedly and somehow, you know, retroactively defeats the Viet Cong. That's when the franchise got good. That's when Rambo would start shooting stuff with arrows and what the targets he would shoot would just blow up without explanation. You know,
like, I'm realizing you and I are literally the polar opposites in our movie taste, in the sense of, let's take the Fast and Furious franchise. I like the first few where they were plausible. They're heists. They're Jesse likes number 7, where the car is jumping from the 100th floor of a skyscraper in Dubai into another skyscraper in Dubai.
And then races a submarine, a nuclear-powered submarine in the Arctic. That's what I want. That's what I see. There is a clip in the last Rambo movie where he saves those missionaries where Rambo literally punches a guy's head off. Like, he punches a head off of a... Okay, Rambo sneaks up behind the guy's like, huh? And then Rambo with his bare hand just swings his dead thick 70-year-old arm
like
and just punches the guy's head off. And the thing is, Stallone's, you know, he thought of that and it's like, oh, I gotta do that, gotta punch a guy's head off. Like, he didn't think, well, this is insane, like this is ruining all plausibility. No, he's just like, no, he'll punch his head off. Like that's what I think. Like, that's why I can't wait for this movie. Like I said, Rambo refuses to work with anyone. So he's going solo, even if he's severely outgunned by Mexican drug cartels. It's Sicario with Rambo, and I'm here for it. I'm here for it. I don't care what you guys say. I'm here for it.
Yeah.
Cameron, you brought up something that I want to revisit because I've never, until this week, I had never seen a single Fast Furious movie. The franchise was a blank slate.
Which one have you seen now?
And then on Tuesday, I watched my very first one, number one. Fast and the Furious, number one, with Paul Walker. And then on Friday, my wife is going to the Ariana Grande show, so I got number two. Me and some friends got number two, and I'm going through number two. You're saying that it starts good and then just gets too stupid to be...
The first few, the first up to 5 or 6 even, are self-aware. They know what they are. They're loving it. It's dope cars, and it's just all the, you know, whatever. The plot is secondary to just the race scenes. It's self-aware.
I am not
an action movie guy at all. Right. For some reason, that franchise became my guilty pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I remember going to the debut opening night of number 6 with Chad Michael Snavely, and there were people cheering and running around the aisles. Like, the whole audience was in on it. You know know what I mean? We were
like
just having
inside joke, like snakes on a plane. Like, dude, it's just we're
having
joke.
A great time, right? What happened was they ran out of ideas, and number 7 and 8 just got so absurd. It wasn't even like fun anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It just
stop
around 5 or 6 and you'll be
because
fine.
Then Dwayne gets involved and he's doing the Dwayne Johnson that like
yeah becomes like
punching nukes out of the sky.
Oh, I'm sorry. Like adding that. Jason Statham and The Rock to movies made them worse. Okay, yeah, believe these two, Chandler.
Yeah. Anyway, all right.
I'm not sure which one I'll be in. We'll see. I'll bring back my reviews every week. I'm sure it'll be a new favorite part of the podcast. I'll review whichever one I've seen.
I don't know
recently.
Why, but number 3, Tokyo Drift, is my favorite.
One's barely even a Fast and Furious movie because like none of the other cast is in it, right? Up until the post credit shot, right?
One dude comes over, and it's just how they introduce some new characters. It's like when The Office went to Connecticut, and then they brought some new characters back to Pennsylvania. That's what Tokyo Drift was. They had to go over to to Japan to bring some new characters back into
see
the
that's
franchise.
That's the thing. Rambo doesn't need to overcomplicate. There's no new characters ever. It's always Rambo and a few hundred random henchmen who die gruesome death at his bare hands for an hour and a half of uninterrupted gratuitous violence. He knows the formula, okay? Like, we don't need to introduce this new stuff. We don't need side plots. Just keep making the same movie over and over again in a different setting and everyone will be happy. And that's what he's done. Good for him. Now it's got Old Town Road. So there, everyone.
for today's youth.
Yeah, get the teens up. The tweens.
For the next 70-year-old Stallone.
Those 300 toddlers from that viral video are all going to line up outside for Rambo Last
Gen Blood. Gen Z is going to be Snapchatting on their who's and what's watching Rambos punch guys' heads off. Take a break from hanging out at the mall and watch Rambo rip a man's throat out and then use that as a weapon to kill 5 more people. It's
hanging out at the mall. I like how your young kid voice is still referring to kids like they're in 2006. Like it's the
Heather Avis's agent just emailed me. Can she please not be on this episode of the podcast? All right,
You rolled the dice, Heather. I don't know what to tell you.
All right, stay tuned. Up next, it slices. You're listening to Isu by Shahid. At the beginning of the podcast, you heard Groceries by Chance the Rapper, his new single. He's about to drop an album, y'all.
Yeah, can't wait.
Have you seen it? Been seeing it on Instagram? He's like, he keeps like saying like
I participated.
Like drop a one of those CD emojis in the comments to get the new album to drop. And I mean, it's like tens and tens of thousands of comments of little like CD emojis.
I was one of them. He got me. I was like, yeah, maybe I'll be the one that tips him over the edge. Yeah. You know? I'll release it today.
And now you're
this
on
guy
his
seems
mailing
like he really
list.
Wants it.
Somehow you're on his mailing list now. I don't know how that works.
I am.
Hey, today's episode is brought to you by one of my favorite brands, Warby Parker. Warby Parker was founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty goal to bring boutique quality eyewear at a revolutionary price point. Prescription eyewear shouldn't cost you more than a plane ticket or a new iPhone. By circumventing traditional channels and engaging with customers directly through their website and retail stores, Warby Parker is able to provide high quality, good looking prescription eyewear at a fraction of the price. Almost 1 billion people worldwide lack access to glasses. This means that 15% of the global population can't effectively learn or work, which is crazy because glasses were invented 700 years ago. Well, Warby Parker partners with nonprofits like Vision Spring to ensure that for every pair of glasses sold, a pair is distributed to someone in need. Warby Parker believes that everyone has the right to see. Warby Parker glasses start at just $95, including the prescription lenses. Lenses include anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings as well. And for people who are concerned about the effects of blue light from screens, I'm looking at you, Jesse, blue light filtering lenses are also now available. Look at that. Have an iPhone X? Make sure to download Warby Parker's app, where you can use their brand new virtual try-on, allowing you to try on eyeglasses, seeing the realistic color, texture, and size of each style using just your phone. I just did this. I did their free home try-on five pairs that they mail to you thing, and I also did the iPhone app, and it's super cool to try everything on virtually. It's awesome. I probably have six pairs of Warby Parkers wow. over the years. I've been a long-term customer. Love their mission, love their style, love their price point. Right now, you can order five pairs of glasses from Warby Parker and try them on for 5 days with no obligation to buy. They ship free and include a prepaid return shipping label. Head over to warbyparker.com/relevant to order your free home try-ons today. Do it. You'll like it. Okay, it's time for...
Slices!
This is going to be a short one.
Well,
what do you have, Jesse?
Thankfully... Huck and I have both become prepared with a twofer because just because it's a skeleton crew duty. Does not mean we're not giving the people the content they demand. Content.
We've already short the listeners.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Not your fault that nobody else could show up today, so we're not going to make you pay for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just because we're running lean and mean doesn't mean we're going to have any less great content. What I want to do for the allotted time for my first slice is re-listen to the Rambo trailer. Chandler, please cue No, it's pretty layered, so listen carefully this time. Okay. I do have two. One kind of goofy, one we can talk about. But this one, okay, listen, we are in the content business. This is what we do. We understand how to get people, you know, to I like to think we understand for the most part of what gets people to read certain things, to take action, to want to engage with content, right? I feel like there's, in the era of digital media and the internet, if you use, you know, those skills correctly, you can really turn people on to, you know, new interesting ideas. Where that strategy does not belong is in the hands of scientists who are potentially sitting on one of the most important discoveries of all time, but are just out here teasing us on what might be. This is what has happened with a group of researchers who are studying biodiversity in Loch Ness to see if the Loch Ness monster is real. So for like 2 years, they've been testing like biomatter at different depths of Scotland's big, you know, body of water, Loch Ness. And they're looking at, you know, fish scales and waste products. And so for years, they've been testing at different levels of the loch to see if there's anything in the DNA that they find that would indicate there's a mysterious creature living down there. So they finally, a year overdue. So this is supposed to be done a year ago, right? You know, there's like a school in New Zealand funding this. So they're supposed to be done a year ago. They just now said, okay, we're just wrapping this thing up. And they said, hey, we have found something that's going to narrow this thing down to two. It's going to be one of these two things. But they're refusing this. They're hijacking the study. They're refusing to unveil what they found. And the news stories kind of allude until they can get like a TV documentary, like a special, like a Shark Week type of special. They're holding on to the greatest discovery in the history of humanity to try to get an hour special. This is this. You don't believe me that they're playing clickbait with this thing. This is literally the quote. So basically, to set some context, they said it's probably one of two things. It's either a dinosaur that has somehow survived the period which dinosaurs are wiped out, meaning there really is a giant, should be extinct sea monster, probably with cool spiritual powers, lurking under those waters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Untapped potential, right? Who knows what kind of spiritual powers they have? Or it's a large sturgeon or giant catfish. It's one of those two things, and they're going to wait to unveil to us. Here is his quote. If you don't believe me that he's just teasing the world, this is what the scientist says. Is there something deeply mysterious? Depends what you believe. Is there anything startling? There are a few things that are a bit surprising. You can't do that. You're a scientist. Oh, you can't tease out the results of a 2 year long study till you get a documentary. Do you guys not find this insane?
Especially at a time when science is under, you know, is under attack from old institutions. People are trying to say, you know, scientists are just out there for the money. We can't trust them. You can't trust anybody but yourself, not even your own lying eyes. I think it's irresponsible for scientists to lean in to that stereotype of themselves as just being these attention hungry, like flash in the pan, just trying to withhold their intellect from the common people, from the lay folks like us. Yeah. I think it justifies all of the worst things people are saying about them. And now I don't know what to believe, because if scientists will be this showy about something like this, then how do I know that the things that they actually say are really quote unquote important, like quote unquote global warming, are really true either?
Well, that's the thing. There's got to be some line between a boring Al Gore PowerPoint presentation. We get it, Al. We got it. This could have been condensed into a much more interesting documentary. You got Stallone to do the voiceover and had Old Town Road play repeatedly in the background. Oh, there's got to be some middle ground between a boring PowerPoint presentation and teasing people out for 2 years. It just enraged me. It just totally enraged me that scientists now are willing to go to like clickbait tactics.
I'm surprised that you're not here for the showmanship, though. That you like a good, you know, you don't want them to just like, oh, release a report. No, you. I'm surprised you're not like loving the pomp and circumstance around the reveal.
Because like I love showmanship if it delivers. It's like here's the thing. It's like if David Blaine set up this insane trick where he had you write his name on a card, right? And he like ate the card at that point. And then, you know, like he had you, you know, turn your clothes inside out, and you're like, oh, where is this trick going? And then at the end, he's like, all right, I'll finish the trick like a year from now. It's sort of like, I'm all for the pomp and circumstance there's payoff. There's no payoff here. We don't know when we're going to get these results. They're wielding science as a clickbait weapon. And we don't even know at this point if there's a monster in the depths of Loch Ness, thanks to these, you know, arrogant scientists. It just has me all rattled, you know?
We don't even know if the world is round anymore.
Yeah, dude, this is no
like
time.
How many facts are they playing with,
Jesse,
right now?
I just don't think that there's any new tool to reveal any new information that we already know. I mean, think about this. Like the era of like the Sasquatch sightings kind of ended when everybody has like high res phones and cameras in their pocket.
Did it.
You know what I mean? Like,
did it.
Like the mysterious, like, ooh, shadowy figure. Like, we don't have those photos anymore. And all of a sudden the mystery goes away. They've had radar, sonar, things that could have scanned it for decades. They would have seen something by now. There's no new information. We've had the technology for decades to reveal if there was something in Loch Ness.
Listen, I want to believe you, but they found something. He said it's a little startling and a little surprising. Does that sound like a giant catfish to you, Cameron? Why would he tease us like that? Why would he tease us? Okay, one more. This one I'm interested in your guys' opinion on. That the EU, you know, there's a potential new policy by the EU that's going to be taken to the European Union court to see if it holds up. The EU now has a law that says electronic commerce does not regulate the territorial scope of an obligation to remove information disseminated via a social network platform. It does not preclude a host provider from being ordered to remove such information worldwide. Here's what that means. The EU right now has a rule that says, like, if there's information that is displayed on social media on accounts in the EU, the social net media platform can be held liable for that. They can be subject to penalties, and the penalties now have real teeth. They can lose up to 4% of annual sales for serious violations. But what this new EU rule says in effect is that even if the content on social media is displayed in parts of the world that aren't accessed to audience in Europe, that the platform can still be held liable for penalties. So that means someone in, you know, hypothetically, you know, Canada or Central America could post something that the EU determines is hate speech, and the EU could fine the platform for that, even if it was never accessed in the European Union. So Facebook is really pushing back on this, saying that no single government institution should have what's in effect power to globally regulate a social media platform. But it's bringing up a lot of debates, not just about the power of the EU, but also what social media is, right? So is social media actually just a platform that delivers information, or is it an information service itself? So like the difference would be, you know, if I watch something objectionable on television, the network that broadcasts that would be held liable. But Tyler, if I called you on my phone and said something objectionable, the phone company wouldn't necessarily be held liable for that, because even though they're providing the platform which that content was delivered on, that, you know, they didn't actually, they're not in charge of regulating it. So this this decision could determine the distinction between whether social media is a communication platform, like, you know, like I said, my internet provider isn't going to be held liable if I email all my friends something that they find offensive, but a radio station or television network word. So basically the outcome of this coming EU decision has major, major implications for how we view social media in the future.
Yeah, it would be it would be the end of social media. I mean, essentially, because like a radio station, a media platform that's held accountable for the content it produces, there's checks and balances, and it is a filtered. I mean, there is a producer, there is a ombudsman, there is a there's an editor making sure that the content is, you know, appropriate and good and quality and engaging and also legal. With social media, the whole reason it is used is that there is no, there is, you know, there is no checks and balances. There is no accountability. There is no filter.
Yeah.
So if they were to, it would be, first of all, impossible to staff that appropriately to filter everything. And two, like, imagine trying to write a tweet and then it goes into a queue to get approved. Like you're buying a Facebook ad.
Yeah.
You know, like you submit the ad and then a human has to approve it. You know what I mean?
But like, these social media places have already, most of them have already implemented some sort of content team that is, that moderates it. Obviously, as we've talked about, I think on this podcast before, they're incredibly over, like, understaffed, and the work conditions are not good and they're paid not well to be looking at some of the worst things on the internet. But Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of these places have teams that you don't send it through a queue, but they are in charge of looking for hate, for things like hate speech.
But that's different. But that's different because, like, they can, it can exist, and then, you know, kind of like, you know, whether they or the public kind of flags it to say this is inappropriate, it will then get removed later. If that happened on a media platform, the FCC would find that radio station.
Yeah.
They, you know, went out, even if later the person got suspended or they said, we're sorry that he said that on the air, they would have a major fine. So the idea that a government regulatory body would be fining Facebook or Twitter, they wouldn't do it retroactively. They wouldn't do it like, well, we'll find the stuff if it pops its head up and pull it. They would have to do it ahead of the game, or else they would be fined out of existence.
Yeah. And, and the other thing too is, like, there's a big major distinction between self-regulation, which is what is happening now, and trying to, you know, enforce a terms of use agreement that a user agrees to when they sign up to the platform, and having a government institution implement global standards for what kind of conduct is appropriate on these platforms, because the standards of, like, the EU are going to be different than the standards of the United States, especially when it comes to what is and isn't considered something like hate speech. Like, if I, you know, like, there are positions that someone could say that are, you know, maybe not the most, you know, that may be kind of blunt. Like, if someone were to say, I believe that if you're not a Christian, then you are guilty of sin or are going to go to hell. Like, it's conceivable. There are some people that could consider that borderline hate speech towards other faith groups. Or you could go to, like, a country that's like a theocracy, like a Saudi Arabia, where they have blasphemy laws where you can't say certain things or it's considered blasphemous. So I hate to use, like, the slippery slope thing, but really that's kind of what's at stake here, is not only what social media is, but what is and what isn't appropriate dialogue on those public platforms.
You know what? A distinction that could emerge would be the difference between public and private accounts. If you think about it, if I'm a public, you know, I have a public account, I'm broadcasting. I'm just putting content out there to potentially millions of people. It can spread, it's, you know, whatever. But, like, I'm thinking about, like, WhatsApp or even Snapchat and stuff. It's more of a closed communication platform. You know, WhatsApp, while quote unquote social media is a closed network, more like a phone call. You know, yeah. It's like, and so, you know, I could see that possibly they would treat private accounts, closed network, closed loop, you know, communication as like phone, unregulated.
Yeah.
And that public accounts would be deemed as a media platform, you know, that it would be a content creator and would be regulated as such. I could see that would be the difference, maybe that all of a sudden Twitter has to make everybody a private account.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. And if you want to have a public account, you submit to regulatory oversight and filters, you know.
Because I think there was a time where places like Facebook and Twitter, like they have just done such a poor job at regulating themselves and enforcing their own terms of agreement that it seems like the, you know, we are in a very dangerous place with them in terms of the hate speech that's being allowed online and in terms of like both ISIS and the alt-right, anti-Semitism and things like that. And people have gotten really hurt by some of these accounts.
Oh, certainly.
So I think that there is, I understand the impetus at play here. And I think that something like what you're talking about, Cameron, might be a reasonable, a potential reasonable sort of compromise between the potential fear of government overreach into the private accounts and freedom of speech issues.
And
the actual safety of people who are being targeted by this.
And if you join a private group or, you know, one of these closed network, you're agreeing to, you know, a waiver essentially that you're releasing the platform of any liability, da da da. You are signing up for this knowingly. I could see that, you know, being an evolution of social media.
Yeah.
Where not everybody has a platform. I mean, it would be a new era. I mean, the democratization of media has radically shifted our business. I mean, it's radically shifted the need for the gatekeepers. And I mean, I was talking to some of my artist friends recently, musicians and stuff. And, you know, 10 years ago, they needed a magazine. They needed a label. They needed to have a manager to have a demo to get on a label so the label could get it into the magazine and the magazine could tell people about them and then they would sell albums. Now they bypass the label, they bypass the gatekeepers, and they just have their own social media following. It's radically changed artistic freedom and you know, democratization of media has been a big thing. I'm wondering if we're going to see kind of almost a reversion back to a gatekeeper mindset or business model.
And it might have to, because like you can see how we've arrived at social media as essentially like an evolution of something as like primitive as like the postal service, where, you know, email was an evolution of physical mail, right? And then, but some of the features on social media are basically like enhancements of what you can do on, you know, that people were doing on email, sending around, you know, funny things and creating big contact lists that, you know, even the way that, you know, an email thread comes together isn't that dissimilar than like a private social media feed. So it's like determining what the distinction is between, like you were saying, Cameron, like a broadcaster and a private network of people communicating to each other that just happens to be using a platform that is digital versus, you know, like I said, if I send offensive letters to my friends, UPS isn't getting fined here, you know? So
I honestly bet we'll see the beginning of the end of the public accounts. I really do. Yeah. No, I'm thinking about it. Like, I mean, that, because anybody could, you know, use it as a pulpit to spew whatever, and then Facebook would be liable. I think they'll just shut that off and make it back to the original intent of Facebook, which was a network of friends, communicate, you know, that kind of thing.
And I do think this calls to mind, there was that incident earlier this week, and what you guys probably heard about, the guy who created a deep fake of Nancy Pelosi in which she appeared to be very intoxicated giving a speech. It wasn't a real video, but it was very convincing. And it was shared. It was retweeted by the president of the United States. So it was shared millions and millions of times by people who evidently believed that it was true. And then this guy who created it is just a private citizen who lives in the Bronx. And the Daily Beast found him and put his information out there they doxed him essentially, which created the tension of, well, should this guy's private, you know, is this just free speech? Is he just doing something? Does he deserve to have his information leaked? But he's also created real content that had a real tangible, obvious effect on public opinion of a major figure in politics. And that's a complicated one. And I think those sorts of issues are going to increase as our social media accounts become more and more in line with actual content instead of just free speech.
Yeah.
and the distance between our phone conversations and the things that we put online, that gulf is getting wider and wider.
Yeah, that's true. But ideologically, the gulf isn't that wide. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just expressing ideas through speech on a different platform, you know? But anyway, it's interesting. And the implications are going to be huge. One. And it should be later this summer that the EU will have their final decision on it.
Well, what they do over in the EU is like, kind of like Narnia.
Yeah, you know? We'll see what those hippies in the EU do before we start worrying about God's country.
All right, what do you have, Tyler?
All right, I also
don't tread on me, Queen.
I'll start with one that's a little more substantive, and then we'll close on a lighter note. So this is an interesting study. Barna just put out a new study that anecdotally, I think I found to be kind of true, but I was a little surprised to find that it's as widespread as it is. The headline of the study is that millennial non-Christians are more interested in Christianity than older generations are. So the study is called Reviving Evangelism, and in it, nearly three quarters of non-Christian millennials who do not profess Christian faith have said that they've had at least one conversation about their religious beliefs with a close friend or family in the past year. That is way above older non-Christians, only 52% of whom said the same thing. Even more interesting, I think, nearly two-thirds of millennial non-Christians had spoken about their beliefs with a Christian. So they talked to a Christian about their beliefs about the Christian faith, compared to just 44% of older non-Christians. Millennial non-Christians are twice as likely to express a personal interest in Christianity and have had more contact with people who attend church than older millennial non-Christians. So in general, you're just seeing a more of a personal interest in the Christian faith than older non-Christian generations had, but also less of a divide. They have more friends who are actually Christians. They have more friends who attend church than older generations did. There's less of a gap between those two groups.
I you got to think of context in this, though. The millennials are 23 to 38. That's a season of life that you're an adult. You're sitting there, you know, discussing with your friends politics, world issues, social justice, war, spirituality, belief. Yeah, I mean, like, it seems to be more of the time in your life where you're exploring worldviews, you're learning, you're forming your own opinion, you're shedding the skin of what your parents raised you as, and you are stepping into your own ethos, right? And when you're in your 40s and 50s, you're settled. You've figured out, by and large, please, I'm not painting with a completely broad stroke, but by and large, this is we are X, I am X. You're not in that evolutionary discovery phase of life. And it's a mature phase. This isn't teenagers. Millennials aren't teenagers, right? They're 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm wondering if they had done this study 20 years ago about Gen X, who were then in their 20s and 30s, would it have been similar?
I think it would be interesting to look at comparative, you know, numbers.
Time of life versus generational. Because to me, that this is apples and oranges.
Yeah.
But like, compare the generations at the same moment.
Yeah.
You know, boomers, when they were 28, did X. Gen X, when they were 28, did this.
Yeah.
Millennials, when they were 28, did this. But just compare 28 to 48 to 68 is dumb.
The other theory that I have on it, though, is that, you know, there used to be sort of that adage that it's impolite in a lot of settings to talk about religion and politics. Like, you know, people just got awkward when those types of topics have gotten brought up. I feel like the social standards of what is and isn't appropriate to talk about in, you know, kind of casual social settings has changed pretty dramatically, where I just feel like it's probably a combination of both time of life, but also shifting social norms, because there really was a time where you would never hear something like the religion of someone on TV mentioned in any sort of meaningful way, right? Like there are, if you watch a lot of like old sitcoms and TVs, that's never a part of it, you know? But now I don't feel like it's that uncommon for a character to be Muslim and that be a meaningful part of that character, or for a character to be a Christian in a way that isn't just like, there's always been like a Ned Flanders or someone who's, you know, a satire of a larger idea. But it does seem like faith is now more a part of people's individual identities than it seems to have been in the past to some degree.
I mean, I would counter that we weren't around in the 60s and 70s and 80s to know.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and is it that it's more open now, or is it just we have more access and information because of social media and blah 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 blah,
yeah,
that we get to know them as people now? Because like with the NBA, which I follow closely, you know, the old school guys, the Isaiah Thomases, Charles Barkley's, whatever, talk about in their day, blah blah blah, and now like we know we only knew what was on the poster in our bedroom about, yeah, our heroes when we were kids. Now we follow them as actual people. And I know Joel Embiid's personality and his thoughts and his, yeah, politics in a way that was just not accessible before. So yeah, I don't know that maybe Charles Barkley was having the same conversations and had the same, yeah, thoughts. But again, it's like that apples and oranges thing. We can't, yeah, compare eras.
And two, at what is it sort of a tail wagging the dog? Like, because this information is more accessible to more people, people are more comfortable giving people access to that information about themselves, you know, right, like how much is technology enabling what may have been a smaller impulse and made it a much larger one, because there's a comfort level that social media has given us to be more authentic, well, seemingly authentic, at least the perception of you can know more of me, you know? So right, it could be, like I said, a kind of a tail wag the dog situation. Tyler, what you had some thoughts about what?
Well, it's just what you're saying does kind of lend itself to conversations that come from different parts of the study. Possibly to your point, Jesse, millennial non-Christians have had much more, almost twice as much personal experience with evangelism, mm-hmm, as older non-Christians. 45% of millennial non-Christians say they've been evangelized to, versus just 26% of older generations.
That shocks me.
That surprises me a lot too. There's
a follow-up question there. What was their like? What are they talking about? They were out clubbing, and the guy at midnight was like preaching, yeah, "You're going to hell" on a megaphone. Because, yeah,
that's a pretty universal experience in the U.S. I think older generations have seen those same street preachers.
Yeah, but that's what makes it interesting.
I'm not sure, but it could also be social media. This could also be via a friend on Facebook, who wouldn't necessarily be like evangelize. Like, do you know where you're going to go when you die? But I've definitely had conversations with my non-Christian friends, which I wouldn't say I was trying to proselytize or convince them or of anything, but was explaining my beliefs in a way that maybe they hadn't heard, they were curious about.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like defining the term I've experienced evangelism, is it that I had a conversation late one night with a group of friends about our spiritual backgrounds, our current belief system, and there was like a spiritual fluidity to it, and somebody grew up in the church, mm-hmm, but here's what they believe now. And then now when I'm asked by a surveyor, I go, yeah, I experienced evangelism. Somebody, yeah, told me that he was a Christian. I mean, like, that's not the same thing. You know, like, again, there's so many follow-up questions to this study that I have, but
yeah. Whatever. Well, honestly, that's a part of a lot of studies that have to do with religion and faith, is like just the simple defining of terms. Like, how do you even define the term evangelism so that everyone's going to apply it the same way? Because like you said, Cameron, someone's conversation with their buddy in the dorm one night, they might say, well, that was evangelistic, you know, where someone else would only, you know, quantify it as a conversation or some sort of interaction that was directly like proselytizing, you know,
right,
like without the definition, yeah, of that term, because
fluid terms.
Well, and plus, let's face it, the word evangelism has become an extremely loaded term. I feel,
yeah,
like
I don't know. I can honestly say I don't know, other than the street preacher with the megaphone, that I've experienced evangelism or come across it.
Yeah,
yeah. Obviously, we have spiritual conversations all the time with our friends and stuff. We talk about what the Lord's doing or what we believe or wrestling with stuff. But like somebody sitting there like, I'm going to go meet with my friend who's not a believer and tell him about Jesus. It just doesn't seem to be as prominent as it was in old past eras.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So again, what are the people who are responding to this survey meaning when they are answering affirmatively to being asked about that term.
Yeah.
Did somebody...
Maybe we should get Kinnaman on the horn.
Yeah, maybe.
Get him on the blower and see if we can track down Adam Smith.
All Dave Kinnaman and I ever have, I mean, discussed in the last 3 years is Orlando Magic, Phoenix Suns basketball. That's all we talk about.
That's a separate podcast.
Hey, David, I'd like to talk to you about two franchises that frankly have been pretty sad the last 5 years. So who, let's see whose fans are more miserable.
Well, that's the reason why we've connected is he's a lifelong Phoenix Suns fan and we both bemoan our misery every season.
Throughout. You got a lot to be sad
about. One last little data point here that's a little more concrete and then we can move on, but I did think this was interesting. According to the study, just under 2/3 of non-Christian and lapsed Christians, this is 62%, said they wanted to talk with a practicing Christian who, quote, listens without judgment, but only 1/3 said they had actually experienced this. So most people are interested in actually like being listened to by a Christian. But they don't feel like, or at least being listened to without judgment, but they also don't feel like that has actually happened for reasons that are kind of hard to determine.
Well, I'll say this. If I'm talking to someone, the first thing I do if they're wearing a tank top is tell them, you're on the fast train straight to the hottest part of hell for that tank top. You can change shirts.
But they've got the attire for it. They'll be nice and cool.
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully, your arms are going to be very breathy down there.
It's a good news, bad news situation.
Hell's very humid. You're going to want to wear a tank top.
Yeah.
Good news is your arms will be slightly more comfortable than the rest of your body. The bad news is it's literally the pit of hell. And I don't know what the dress code is, but yeah, I forgot to mention it is forever. So make sure that the color scheme on the tank stays in the style.
Can I say that there's an easy solution here for this priest? Literally, the easiest solution. He doesn't have to offend anybody. He didn't have to go on Twitter. Just when it comes to Sunday services, crank the AC. Yeah. Exactly. Literally make it 60 degrees in the church. And nobody's wearing a tank top.
Or I got a better one. How about you just lighten up a little? That seems like you could do it too. Just chill out. How about we just chill out on the people in tank tops and worry about their souls, not their arms?
Doesn't cost you a dime. Yeah. Well, I think the Catholic Church understands, they got their priorities in the right place right now.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not a lot of issues.
Why don't you stop being such a nerd and worrying about tank tops and worry about, why don't you... Make sure everything's kosher.
You're taking care of the big things. Now it's just fine tuning.
Well, yeah, you might want to have just a discussion.
Just tweaking the dress code.
Your buddies up at the Vatican because I don't think they're really, doing too hot these days.
All right. We got some Catholic listeners. Let's take it easy.
They'll probably agree. They're probably wearing tank tops right now going, that's right. Sun's out, guns out. That is right. Take that, Frankie. Pope Francis.
But for that, hey, they need to make a Christian tank top. That it's S-O-N, sun's out, guns out, and they wear it to church.
I really want to go. I don't know where that guy's church is, and I've never thought about protesting a church before, but it'd be very, very funny to show up there in a tank top with a big sign that says sun's out, guns out, but it's S-O-N. And just like...
Yeah, I really like this tank idea and would buy the relevant merch version of it. This is
Karen,
very funny.
I'll go with sun's out, guns out. Karen, you go with... I demand the right to bear arms, and it's bare arms.
It's actually
bare arms.
Yeah, B-A-R-E. Yeah. Bare arms.
It's summer. It's getting.
I demand the right to bear arms.
I will tell you right now. By the time this podcast goes up in 5 hours, there will be 2 tank tops at the relevant store, store.relevantmags.com. The right to bear arms and suns out, guns out, S-O-N, will be available.
There will be way
purchase.
Less than 2 because I'm buying 5 for every day of the week, Monday through Friday. My new work uni.
Yeah.
My new work uniform.
One for the evening, one for the mornings. Yeah. Because if I'm wearing tanks to work, I'm working up a sweat. You better believe that.
That'll do it for Slices. Stay tuned. Up next, Heather Avis joins us. So leave the clothes and mess we made up all on the floor. Because when we put them on, we're not in love anymore. Because I know when we go, we're really good. You're listening to Verite. The song is Gone. Well, this episode is also brought to you by Blinkist. Being able to practice mindfulness every day is something we all want to achieve, and sometimes it can be really hard when we're overwhelmed with work and other aspects of life. Well, there's an app I highly recommend which might help you to be more mindful every day. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down to just 15 minutes so you can read them or listen to them. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of the books quickly without reading the entire thing. With an audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy to finish 4 books a day while you're on the go. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health, to history books, and a lot more. I am a subscriber and download Blinkist books all the time. You can easily listen in the car and get great recommendations on what to read next. Some of the most popular books in the mindfulness and happiness category include The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, and Start With Why by Simon Sinek. Lots of good stuff. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just the Relevant podcast audience. Go to Blinkist.com/relevant to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist.com/relevant to start your free 7-day trial. Well, Heather Avis is a speaker and author of The Lucky Few and her latest book, Scoot Over and Make Some Room, Creating Space on the Armrest on Airplanes. No, Creating a Space Where Everyone Belongs. In it, she describes how the experience of being the adoptive parent to 3 young children, 2 of whom have special needs, opened her eyes to the ways that churches can be more inclusive spaces. Jesse, you talked to her, right?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Heather and her work. And, you know, this book in particular is very challenging. And that's what I think to come across in the interview. But I do feel like it's important to set some context for how she kind of arrived at a lot of the observations about kind of ways that the church really needs to improve and Christian communities need to improve, which is how her life changed. You know, she's an adoption advocate. And when they started adopting children, it kind of led to this perspective shift. But I want to give that context of her telling a little bit of her backstory.
We ended up with 3 children who were not born of my womb, 2 of whom have Down syndrome. And it changed the trajectory of our lives forever and for the better. And so with this new book, Scoot Over, Make Some Room, it basically, I've been parenting for 10 years, which isn't a super long time, but it's plenty of time. And I've just say when we step out our front door, my kids are stepping into a world that continues to fail to see their full value and worth. And that's unacceptable. And so there's that piece of my kids will be seen as exactly as they are, as valuable and worthy and incredible humans. And also my life is so much richer because I've been catapulted into these spaces of doing life with people who are so different than I am.
The you know, experience of having such a diverse family, you know, kind of, and wanting to create a world that in the future is better than the one that we have now, really led to some eye-opening things about the church when it came to diversity. And here's why she thinks that, you know, there are a lot of failings that need to be addressed.
I think that the church, quite frankly, and when I say the church, like air quotes, big C church, right? I think that's what you're saying. The church, yeah, is totally failing. For whatever reason, it's become this incredibly homogenous, comfortable place, which is, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of Jesus, the total opposite of what the church should be. So we have found personally, and then in interacting with, at this point in life, thousands of families who have a loved one with a disability or Down syndrome, that the church is one of the first places to other them, to segregate them. And there's that, there's like a statistic, and don't quote me here, but that talks about how Sunday mornings are the most racially segregated hour of the week. So we're still doing church life homogeneously. And I understand that for people of color. I feel like a lot of people of color should. I mean, that's like such a safe, church should be such a safe hour. And yes, be with people who are like you. And you can go all the way back historically into like when slavery was happening, and that Sunday hour was such a safe place for African American people. But if we look at God and we look at just creation, period, and we see all the diversity that's been created and that we should be living together, and we talk about people being image bearers. And so if we don't, I believe that if we're not intentionally doing life with people who are different than us, who are image bearers of God, then we're missing out on the fullness of God.
Yeah. I think, you know, her thoughts there are extremely challenging. I mean, you know, a lot of churches are self-segregated. You know, people end up, you know, I don't want to say everyone, but there are a lot of people that end up, you know, going to church with people who are just like them. And when that happens, not only do you, you know, like she says, automatically kind of make people feel like other, you know, not inclusive, but you also lose out on really valuable perspectives and ideas and the way that God, you know, expresses himself through different people within his creation. And that's why she said it's so important to be intentional about creating diverse communities, especially in the world of faith. And here's what she said about that intentionality.
I think the fact that we are, as the church, continuing to do life, to do church real comfortably, and which means we're not making space for people who are different than us. We don't have intentional space for people with disabilities in our congregations, or we're not being intentional about bringing people, about creating a Sunday morning environment that is a place where all different ethnicities can thrive together, that we're just, we're going to continue to be broken and hurting.
I think that's super interesting and something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I hope the conversation at church gets there, because I do think there's a growing awareness of the importance of diversity and welcoming people who aren't like us, whether that be in terms of race or in terms of people who are developmentally disabled too. I think that representation is hugely important. But I think a lot of the failing is for a lot of people like us is that we kind of think that just by acknowledging that we need to have that, we feel like we've done something really good. We pat ourselves on the back. And I'm glad to hear the conversation that Heather's conversation is moving towards intentionality. Not enough to just say diversity is important and let it go from there. It's tough. Like, it's not an easy thing. It takes disruption to your own social circles. It's hard.
Sometimes it's geographical, you know, sometimes by
proximity,
where you live, or where, or who the people that you grew up with, or the denomination that you are most familiar with. But I want to close out with something she said along those lines, that, you know, for people that, you know, encounter her work and read her story in this book in particular, knowing that, listen, it might take some hard work in getting outside of your own personal comfort zone, but in the end, that's worth it. Here's how Heather put it.
I hope that the reader just does a really deep evaluation of who is around them. Of the who around them, and just takes notice of people around them who are different, notices who is there, and then notices who's missing. And is that awareness is so important. And then it hopefully translates into action, would be the ultimate goal. I feel like this is one of those books that really is asking the reader to do some hard work. And I know that we live in a world that's like all the self-help books about how awesome you can be in, you know, all like the you books. This is quite the opposite. But in the long run, ultimately, when you do make space in your life for people who are different than you, it gives you a richer, more worthy life. So it's like doing that hard work relationally will actually benefit you so much in the long run.
Yeah, such a great message. And I just, I love like that cultural counter narrative where it's not all about, you know, you and fulfilling your desires and no, do some hard work, get out of your comfort zone and really, you know, understand how full your life can be when you experience other people and other perspectives. And so anyway, the book is Scoot Over, Make Some Room, and big fan of Heather Avis and not only what she's doing professionally, but in her personal life too. Just such an awesome, inspiring person to talk to.
There you go. Well, awesome. That was Heather Avis. Stay tuned. Up next, it's your feedback.
Stay with me among the strangers. Change your mind and nothing changes. Don't let show any emotion when you climb into the ocean.
You're listening to The National. The song is Rylan. Jess Collins. I'm very happy about that.
Shout out, Jess. We got some Weezer coming up, too. We got all the hottest tunes from the mid-aughts coming to you. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, you have to say anything.
All right, it's time for your feedback. Last week, we brought you the hard-hitting news of the softest rock supergroup possible.
Tyler, don't back down now.
I am not backing down.
The 1990s.
Tyler, Tyler already apologizing. Listen, we said nothing to get them all mad, and I don't care that they are.
It's because Tyler lives, he anchors our Nashville bureau.
There, I'm a disruptor.
He's the sole occupant of the relevant Nashville bureau.
The entirety.
He's got to go to the coffee shops where these guys hang out, and so us mentioning.
Got my poster plastered all over town now.
Hold my Frappuccino, Rick. This guy said I rock softly.
Yeah. We mentioned last week the news that there's a 1990s CCM supergroup being formed with members of some of the bands that you grew up listening to. Dan Hastein from Jars of Clay, Kevin Max from DC Talk, and others. And it just got us thinking of what other CCM supergroups need to be formed. So that was the question of the week. You guys hit us up on Twitter at Relevant Podcast. You also posted on the podcast episode page at relevantmagazine.com. There's a lot of suggestions.
Good stuff.
Okay.
Here are a few of our favorites.
All right. Before we jump into the suggestions, you may also remember, Cameron, that we suggested there's a scale of rocking softly, right?
That's right. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the softest.
As the deer.
As the deer. And 10 being
To Hell with the Devil
by Stryper. We wanted to know not only your CCM supergroup, but where on the spectrum numerically would they fall on the soft rock spectrum.
That's right. Well, Matt went ahead and flushed out the whole spectrum 1 to 10, if you guys would like to hear it.
And he did a great job.
I feel
job.
Like he nailed it.
This is on the money.
And you know, if some of these have your Spotify pulled up, fans, if you want to hear the spectrum for yourself. But number one is As the Deer. I think we're all familiar with that gentle hymn. Number two
not a hymn, but okay.
Well,
yeah, it's a hymn.
I mean, it's not the book.
It wasn't written like 800 years ago.
I think it's from the Psalms. I think it's directly from the Psalms.
No, it is. It is a psalm, but it is not a hymn from the hymn book.
I don't know what the distinctions.
Either way, I'm not a scientist. Either way, we can say this. Nothing rocks softer than As the Deer. Whether it's in the hymn book, whether when David was pinning it, you know, in the Psalms.
He was pretty chill.
Yeah, David's writing it by himself, and he hands it over to the Selah musicians. And they're like, David, this one rocks pretty softly, man. This is not your hardest rock work here. And he's like, it's okay. It's As the Deer Pants for the Water.
He's like, we're in the
not
cave. It's a little stressful. We're being chased. I think we need to just chill it out a little bit.
Yeah.
Here's the As the Deer.
Yeah. This is Dad, David. This is post the Giants way in the past.
He's retired the tank top. He's wearing cardigans and pinning As the Deer at this point.
That's right.
He's no longer slinging rocks.
So that's number one. Number one on the spectrum.
Acoustic harp.
According to Matt, that's still number one.
Number two is the song Anything by For Him. I'm not familiar with that one.
I'm not familiar. I remember For Him, but I don't know the song.
No, I don't think it's the song. I think he said Anything by For Him. Is number two.
Very good. Very good, Matt.
You didn't put quotes around the word Anything. It just says Anything by For Him.
You're right. Anything by For Him. So they're just slightly above As the Deer. Cranking it up to number three is the song Great Adventure.
Stephen Curtis Chapman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Saddle up your horses.
Yeah. So saddle up your horses. Yeah. So that's up to three. Number four is the song Breakfast by the Newsboys, who makes, you know, the things I've always appreciated about the song about them not serving breakfast in hell is that it's taken the stark idea of an eternal resting place of torment for those who reject Christ and make it a big joke about eating cereal. So number four, Breakfast in Hell by the Newsboys. Number five, Jars of Clay's Flood, right in the middle.
Which we said in the show last week.
Okay, number six. This is where it gets interesting. Number six, I would have had this higher, Meant to Live by Switchfoot.
I get it, though.
No, that's just a notch above Flood. It's perfect.
I, I think it's perfect because I also think that rock is sort of an ethos, like lyrically, and Meant to Live. While the songs are songs definitely plugged in, the amps are turned up. It's also not a very like punk
it's
ethos
very
to get out there and really live your life.
Yeah. It's encouraging.
To the full,
yeah.
Make it,
well,
yeah,
it, it definitely.
It's not anarchistic enough.
Yeah, it ratchets it up from there. I'll blow through this last one. 2008 Skillet, which, you know, pretty hard rock. Followed by the song Jesus Freak by DC Talk at number eight. Yeah.
Love it.
Youth
Love
of a Nation by POD at number nine. So POD is holding down the top end there. And then finally To Hell with the Devil by Stryper. So that is the scale because throughout the scale will be mentioned. I want to start with Beth. Her band name is called Just a Little Bit Secular. And it features three artists who had their roots in Christian music, but have since expanded their horizons. Joy Williams, Katy Perry, and the Jonas Brothers. And they are they're about a four on the soft rock scale for a little bit secular.
A little pop out.
More than a little bit secular, but I like but I see where she I know what she's working with.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd listen. I like all right. I gotta hand it. Tip of the cap to Juan. I think this would be a good one. From Audio Adrenaline, for the lead singer Kevin Max. From the Newsboys, he'd bring in Michael Tate, and then he'd want some sort of hip hop presence, maybe Toby Mac. He'd bring those three titans of Christian music together. He'd get them all in the same room, see what sort of magic had. Who knows? A combustible, it's like a cocktail of some of the greatest Christian rock acts ever. We'll see what happens. He says that he notes that it would be perfect for cruises, which I couldn't agree more.
Yacht rock. Hey, don't you love it how half of CCM is already one big super group? Like they already are all part of each other's bands. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Aaron had this one.
CCM is basically like when they broke up AT&T or the Bells back in the, and they made like 10 different companies out of the AT&T.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So Aaron said CCM supergroup, Michael W. Smith, Stryper, and the Supertones join forces to become the Michael W. Stryper Tones. Michael W. Smith dulcet vocal tones combined with the roaring horn section and dueling guitar solos would be, you know, pretty fun. It's also a number five on the rock scale. I would think that'd be higher, but
I'd crank it up a little bit, maybe. Yeah, I think going higher than
Jimmy is a fan of the awkward. He's a fan of the Scott's Tots, and he says his Christian music supergroup would just be an insanely awkward duo of Michael Gunger and Chris Tomlin, where they play mashups of their music to an audience of liturgist and CCM fans. So just nobody's happy. Nobody's happy with the pairing.
No, definitely both sides are very displeased at that concert.
Yeah. Which, everybody storms out. Yeah. Storms out.
I like Zach's gone topical here. He's created a band for our time. Not only is this a super group, but it also is relevant to today's world. How about a DC Talk Newsboys crossover band where they just sing super hard rock covers of CNN news headlines called, wait for it, DC Talk. No, hold on. DC News Talk Boys.
DC News Talk Boys.
That sounds like a YouTube channel, one of those conservative YouTubers.
Well, that's the thing.
They're
making songs. They're making songs out of news coming from Washington. That's why the DC News Talk Boys. Yeah. Of course, they would be an 8 out of 10 on the scale. So pretty hard.
And he also pointed out that cruise would be very polarizing. It would be very.
That'd be more uncomfortable than a liturgist Chris Tomlin concert, I believe.
There's a lot more where that came from. Go check them out on the podcast episode page at relevantmagazine.com. Okay, it's time for this week's
editorial question of the week.
Okay, well, earlier in the show, we got talking about the hard-hitting, the big issues. We talked about the big issues facing the church today. We talked about, you know, segregated congregations. We talked about the need for diversity. We talked about just a lot of the things that the Big C church needs to grapple with. But most importantly, tank tops. Got us thinking about times maybe we were in youth group or times we were in church and we got called out by the pastor or pulled aside after youth service. Hey, don't do that again. Don't wear that shirt. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we all got our hands slapped for getting out of line. We want to know your stories of times you got reprimanded for something at church, like the person who wore the tank top and the priest said, please don't wear tank tops anymore. We want to know stories of your time getting your hand slapped at church growing up, or even as an adult, maybe.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe you brought a shofar, and the worship leader didn't enjoy that. Yeah. You know what I mean? And after service,
maybe you didn't know that this church isn't appropriate to do mid worship victory laps around. But you took off running full sprint and got stopped. You know, I don't know. We want to hear your story.
But maybe you haven't done it. Maybe you saw somebody do something that got corrected after service or during service. Tell us those stories.
I will say this. I've had numerous occasions where I've grown up.
I got a lot of these.
Okay. I want to know if you've ever experienced this, because you grew up in more, I guess the only word I can think is more like charismatic-y type of evangelical churches, where there are times in the services where people are asked if they have a word for the congregation. I know that's controversial in some denominations, but in a lot of evangelical churches, not that uncommon. The assistant pastor, and I know this because I know some of these assistant pastors, are taught to never let the mic leave their hand. So the person comes down from the crowd, they said, I have a word for the congregation.
Well, it's not even, not only the word, a lot of churches will do like testimony, and give your testimony. Mm-hmm. Well, same thing. Pastor will not let go of the mic.
I have seen basically like covert wrestling matches at the front of the church, because the person thinks, okay, I'm grabbing the mic and it's my time now. You know, I'm going to do my thing here. And, the assistant pastor has that kung fu grip because they're instructed if they're holding the mic, they can pull it away when things start getting weird, which if you've been to enough of those services, it will get weird. So I've witnessed that many times. And the thing is both of them are pulling on the microphone, but they're both playing it super cool as if they're not yanking on the microphone.
I've seen it trembling. You see it shaking in their hands. They're both pulling.
One time the congregant was wearing an inappropriate tank top and veins were just bursting out of their arms. That's how you could tell. It was quite the scene. And then Sylvester Stallone left and punched somebody's head off. Tyler, what did you see?
I've seen it. The only thing, the first thing that came to mind, and like I said, there have been a few of these moments, but what I saw was maybe somebody who didn't have a lot of familiarity with dating when he was a child finally worked up the courage to hold his new girlfriend's hand during church. That somebody, the youth pastor, may have looked towards this hypothetical person and just said, watch it, buddy, as he walked by, shaming him into not holding hands again, probably until the day I walked down the aisle, or whoever this is walked down the aisle for his own wedding.
Or whoever it is. Oh my gosh. Watch it, buddy, from a holding of
watch
hands.
Watch it, buddy, from a hand-holding situation.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah, that's wow. We don't
watch
need to.
It,
we, don't to we, don't, we don't have time to unpack all of the lingering trauma that's left in me.
That's good. That's good. All right. Hit us up with your stories on Twitter at Relevant Podcast, or you can post your longer ones on the podcast episode page at relevantmagazine.com. Well, many thanks to Blinkist for making the show possible. Remember, you can go to blinkist.com/relevant to start your free 7-day trial. It's a great app. You'll like it a lot. Also, thanks to Warby Parker. Remember, you can order 5 pairs of glasses and try them on for 5 days with no obligation to buy. Everything ships free and includes a prepaid return shipping label. Head over to warbyparker.com/relevant to order your free home try-ons today. Also, thanks to Heather Davis for joining us. Her new book, Scoot Over and Make Some Room, is available for pre-order right now. Definitely want to check it out. Well, on that note, we will wrap things up. I'm Cameron Strang.
I'm Chandler Strang.
I'm Jesse Carey.
I'm Tyler Huckabee.
We will see you on Friday. Have a good week, everyone.
She likes the club, but she don't dance, though. I text a kitty and she takes me back, hello. I'm like simple lemonade. I'ma play my cards right. I ain't talking space. They should be afraid.
Thank you for listening to the Relevant Podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. Check out other shows from the Relevant Podcast Network in the podcast section at relevantmagazine.com. And while you're there, browse exclusive podcast merchandise at our online store. Make sure to subscribe to Relevant Magazine. Info is available at relevantmagazine.com/subscribe.
Gen Z is going to be Snapchatting on their who's and my what's, watching Rambos punch guys' heads off.
Relevant Podcast Network.